I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE in the Middle East. It's been a week since US, UK, EU-backed nuclear-armed Israel sabotaged US-Iran talks in Oman. It aerially bombarded the Islamic Republic of Iran, even as it sent untold numbers of children to their deaths in Gaza, queuing for bread. The US and its vassal NATO colonies emphasize Israel's rights, while President Trump tells 15 million men, women and children in Tehran to evacuate in the middle of the night as artists, scientists and children are killed with indiscriminate NATO weapons. Israel, after mass killing of journalists in Gaza, has struggled to control its Zionist propaganda, bombing Iran's main TV station and imposing blanket censorship in Israel. At the time of recording, Colonel Tulsi Gabbard, the US Director of National Intelligence, is still in post, despite her boss, Donald Trump, on Air Force One, saying he didn't care what she said. Gabbard had said U.S. intelligence shows Iran was not seeking a nuclear bomb. Many in Iran and all around the global south will now wonder why not. In London, again, is Daniel Levy, veteran Israeli peace negotiator under Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. He currently serves as the president of the U.S. Middle East Project. Daniel, thanks so much for coming back on. So it's finally happened after Yemen, bombing Lebanon, bombing Syria. We have nuclear-armed Israel backed by the United States, Britain and the European Union nations, opposed by the Arab world, opposed by the UAE, where I'm speaking to you from. There's a war on Iran while the execution camps go on in Gaza. Why?
Why indeed, Afshin? And I think you've partly set out the backdrop to this. Yes, we can start by looking at what Israel has been doing over the last year plus. It's weakened some of the deterrence that Iran has established. So it felt like this might be the time before Iran can restore some of that even domestic capacity regarding its own airspace. But I think that one can look at that military equation. One certainly shouldn't take too seriously what the Israeli government has been saying, which is Iran was lurching towards weaponizing its nuclear program. You quoted Tulsi Gabbard there. Neither the American nor any other intelligence agency in the world has made that designation. The Israelis have provided no evidence. So let's look elsewhere for the reasoning. And I think we don't have to look much beyond.
I mean, as a negotiator yourself,
just to say where I would look, I don't think you go too far wrong if you start by looking at the Israeli domestic political equation. So let's first say that Israel has a prime minister who is in last chance saloon when it comes to being in a position where he can win an election. He's managed to stabilize and be in a position where he can stay in government, but he hasn't positioned himself to actually win an election, and Israel is approaching the starting line of an election, number one. Number two, you have to shift the narrative away from Gaza. I'm not saying you're about to see Israel's allies turning on it, but the extent of the transparency of the genocidal intent and actions was being difficult to manage. It doesn't take very much to get your Western allies back saying Israel's right to self-defense, even though it's the aggressor, to get them back saying, we stand with Israel. So it has succeeded in doing that. And thirdly, this is about something much bigger, which is, can it establish itself as the regional hegemon, while at the same time, it is pursuing ever more radical, destabilizing, and let's be honest, extreme messianist ways of conducting itself in the region. And that's something we may talk about more later.
Yeah, point taken about Netanyahu and his imminent jailing, perhaps, over corruption. But as a negotiator under two Israeli prime ministers, are you not focusing too much on Israel? There's another messianic constituency in another country, as you know, the United States. What about, as some are suspecting, that the so-called deep state, I know it's a rough term, has always wanted this to happen? Iran was on that list outlined by General Wesley Clark. And you're giving Israel too much credit for this whole operation. This was always the plan. They'd have used any American president, and they're using this one as the precursor, perhaps, to China. And Trump is at least being able to pivot away from the Ukraine situation in Eastern Europe. in order to pivot away from that, he's given away this, which is what they always wanted, a attack on Iran, the destruction of the Iranian government before the BRICS dream is finally over.
So it's an interesting question. Where does primary agency in this lie? And I would say the following. Israel conspicuously failed to get America to initiate for decades, despite the fact that that same constituency inside the US, evangelicals, neoconservatives, some of the hawkish military establishment, some of the military industrial complex, would have liked for this to happen for an awfully long time. And that's why I would argue, Avshin, that primary agency and instigation and initiation lay with Netanyahu and on the Israeli side. But you are right to point out that he would not have taken the action if he didn't get the green light from Washington. And so we asked ourselves the question, why now the green light from Washington? Many of the factors that we've already just mentioned come into play. Look, I think this is a president who, one, shouldn't underestimate the gullibility at the top level. You put an easy argument, a simple argument in simple terms. We're ready to go in and do this, Mr. President. Negotiations are stuck because you haven't established enough of a threat perception on the Iranian side. Negotiations are stuck elsewhere. This will unstick things. Of course, that's a totally fallacious way of understanding how the negotiating process might unfold. But I think that's what they've gone with. Secondly, never underestimate the extent to which Israel has so many multiple points of access and influence in the US. And there, of course, they fell on very primed and ready and eager ears in making this argument. Then the question becomes, how confident was Netanyahu that in addition to providing defensive cover, taking out Iranian attempts at responding, in addition to providing the arms, the political, the economic, etc. cover, how confident was Netanyahu that he could, once he initiated this, draw the Americans in militarily? As you said, Avshin, we're talking at a time where it's extremely dynamic. By the time, you know, people see this, it may be that we've seen American military action. It may be that we haven't. But what we do know from the moment we're discussing this is that Israel is doing everything to bring the Americans in. It may take less than they assumed. They may have assumed they needed to provoke Iran up to the point of Iran actually itself or via allied militias striking America. They may have thought they needed to do a false flag operation. It may take less than that. But let's also acknowledge at the same time two things. First, this is not an entirely easy sell in MAGA world, right? We've seen this massive food fight in Trump's own constituency amongst his supporters. We know that for many who put him in power, making America great again, as they call it, is not about making Israel whatever Israel wants to be. It's America first, not Israel first. So it's not an absolute slam dunk in that respect. And secondly, Trump can flip on a dime. So as we're talking, military action looks more likely. By the time we finish talking or people listen to us talking, it may be that there was a negotiation track opened. I think Israel is making sure that negotiations are made as impossible as they can, trying to suggest to Trump and his people that the bar for a negotiation has to be a total Iranian capitulation. They won't get that. Trying to embarrass the other side, trying to tell Trump that any desire to negotiate is a sign of weakness.
Yeah, I wanted to get onto the negotiation, but as you say, you false flag, the MAGA base already on social media speculating about whether the USS Nimitz will be the subject of a false flag operation as Trump sends the aging aircraft carrier there. But on that agency equation, I mean, you were a negotiator under Barak and Rabin. I presume you'd say that the equation of agency has changed. It didn't feel in Taba and in Oslo that the United States was running the Israelis. It felt much more even perhaps? I mean, would you say that today it's not the case that it's even? It is the American... I mean, you're saying it's the Israeli lobby basically running rings around the MAGA movement and the administration in Washington. Some would say it's the other way around, Lindsey Graham, perhaps, that it's the Americans running Israel.
Yeah, I don't think that you can draw... Okay, so... No, so then it did feel like... And remember, we're talking here about the Palestinian file, so to speak, right? So it does feel like Israel had a tremendous amount of wiggle room, of agency in that respect. It would make the decisions. In fact, when it came to that particular issue, many of us, of those of us who were hoping that this had been entered into with an intent to actually get an outcome that could be, to use that phrase, acceptable on both sides, could be sellable to an Israeli public, could be sellable to a Palestinian public, acknowledging all the asymmetries, etc. But I guess the thinking then was America would have to weigh in and hold Israel's feet to the fire to actually get this done. Of course, the story of Oslo, if you like, for some people, born with the intentionality of reshuffling the deck of occupation and making it easy for Israel to continue. If you give a more generous interpretation to the intentionality behind it, then the story is the American unwillingness to hold Israel's feet to the fire and make a deal. What you're suggesting is that the center of gravity in the US all along was to make sure that Israel didn't cede land, didn't cede territory, and that Israel was this putative and now attempting to actually become regional hegemon in the Middle East as an American-backed entity. I don't think the evangelicals were quite as strong in the 90s, and I don't think they're all determining right now either. So I think this is, what I'm suggesting is that on the American side, there are forces that pull in different directions when it comes to what they want from Israel, what they want it to do, what role they want it to play in that part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, Tucker Carlson and the host and Steve Bannon were very clear that they, and one has to go by these individuals, can't use any other tools, it seems, to analyze the Trump presidency than very vertically upwards. They said it's ridiculous that the Oman talks were deliberately sabotaged by the Trump administration. Then Trump knew that the attack on Iran would be occurring hours before the negotiators were due to meet in Muscat.
Yes, and you're not going too far wrong if I think you hold the two, at least two thoughts simultaneously, which is, number one, this is part of something deeply embedded in the DC blob, in the American system, in terms of how Iran is viewed. You made the broader point that it's not just Iran, it's a continuum in the BRICS world, in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran is seen in that mix by the DC blob. So that's part of the story. But I also think one has to simultaneously hold the idea, because I think it's relevant to what
goes on.
Hold
that thought, Daniel Levy. I'll stop you there. More from the former Israeli peace negotiator and Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Daniel Levy, former Israeli peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin, and now president of the U.S. Middle East Peace Project. Daniel, I interrupted you when you were talking about this case of whether the dog is wagging the tail or the tail wagging the dog.
Yeah, so let's, you know, never underestimate the extent to which America intentionally and sometimes just through plain old ignorance misperceives its adversaries, how it reads the world. They've been duped many times, and I don't think each one of those has been intentional. I don't think they intended Iraq to be the debacle that it was. So that's one piece.
A dupe by Israel, because Netanyahu was telling George W. Bush to do that.
But again, Avshin, by this combination of Israel and people who, some are Israel's useful idiots inside the US, but others saw this, see Israel as the useful idiot. Like, great that we've got this lobby. We want an America that's doing these things, and we've got Israel to come in and make the case and have a constituency that backs it, et cetera, et cetera. What I'm suggesting in the current situation is one also has to factor in, I think it's fair to say, are the peculiarities of the Trump administration. And therefore, we should understand that their understanding of the material, the depth of familiarity, the extent of their learning what it is they're talking about with the Iranians, who they're negotiating with, what realistic parameters are. You know, Witkoff is 0 for 3, okay? Gaza, Iran, Ukraine, unless one assumed he was sent to fail on all of them. I don't necessarily think he was. I don't think he was. So he doesn't have a team of wise people around him, because you have this peculiar situation where it seems that the president himself could go either way. So then you need... Yeah, who's influencing negotiators? Do they know what they're doing?
Yeah, can an Israeli... Albeit, if Witkoff had a bigger team, they'd be filled with deep state CIA Mossad operatives. People have actually applauded the fact he's alone, this billionaire real estate man. And he was able to stop the killing in Gaza when the inauguration occurred for Donald Trump, which shows he's able to do
it. What happened there is... that Netanyahu looked at this and said, I don't want to get on the wrong side of this administration. As soon as they got into the weeds, they got absolutely bamboozled, took Israeli talking points, turned them into American talking points. What happened on Iran? Similar. So it is the advantage of this slim, not beholden to the regular DC blob types, but that advantage doesn't hold if they are then so easily led by the nose when the Israelis say, Libya model. No, it doesn't work. Zero enrichment. When the Israelis say, instead of Oman, next round of talks, we'll bomb and then they'll come to Oman in a week, 2 weeks with their tail between their legs. They didn't have the smarts. If they actually want to deal, they didn't have the smarts to say, no, that's not how it works, mister. One of the things we saw is that because of the peculiarities of this administration, and this goes back again to where is agency? Because of the peculiarities of this administration, I get the sense that Netanyahu felt he was on the back foot because the president went to the region and he went to the Gulf and he went to where you are and two neighboring states, Saudi and Qatar, and this is where he liked to be and he didn't go to Israel. And when he came away from the Gulf, he came away with his wallet stuffed. And he knows if he goes to Israel, he has to start emptying his wallet, to put it bluntly. And the Israelis didn't like to be in that position, not because it was going to be massively necessarily used against them in the short term, but it is a change. And I think Netanyahu thought, I have to challenge that. And I think that's part what we're seeing going on.
Yeah, I don't know about the reporting over there in Britain of what's happening. I know the Prime Minister there, Sir Keir Starmer, keeps just going on and on about Israel's right to self-defense and not about any breach of Article 51 of the UN Charter. And I know I have the Japanese Financial Times here. Israel claims control of Tehran skies, just repeating this kind of stuff. Any reporting that the United Arab Emirates, where I'm speaking to you from, and Saudi Arabia, both the places Trump visited, they have condemned what Israel has done? And that the Straits of Hormuz may be shut by the time this is broadcast, and it'll affect pensioners and the poor in Britain and Western Europe?
Yes, I think the media and the political class have been leading with... No, they haven't.
I thought for a second, because, you know, I was at the BBC Today program during the Iraq WMD disaster, and our source, David Kelly, he died. I don't know for this war on Iran what they've got up their sleeve.
So you are seeing, I think, another example, and it came out for me very powerfully with the statement issued by the G7. Trump couldn't wait to get out of that, but nonetheless, they came together to issue a shameful, ridiculous statement didn't mention Israel as the belligerent aggressor, didn't mention that Israel has a nuclear weapons program. It's not an NPT signatory. It was Israel, it was their happy place. Israel is victim, Israel's right to self-defense, the threat of Iran, and what it felt like. And it's echoed in the media, and that's where the political class is. It felt like they are, again, almost cutting themselves off from the rest of the world. Europe has totally marginalized itself. Throughout the atrocities and the war crimes that Israel has been committing in Gaza, they have failed to find a narrative and a set of actions that make them anything of relevance in a world in which the international multilateral architecture and the international legal structures still have any salience. And they have done that yet again, because as you note, there are things to do with IEA safeguard protocols for states in the NPT who do have a right to civilian enrichment. What Israel has done is extremely dangerous in that respect. It's a violation of those safeguards. It's violated the sovereignty and territorial integrity of another state, again, a violation of the UN Charter. So it heaps layer upon layer of, you know, this not being a serious set of actors. And I think the world increasingly sees it that way when they ever talk about those norms. And I do think that most of the rest of the world, just as they have voted in a different way in the UN on Gaza, does not want to see the kind of radicalizing, destabilizing actions of the Israeli state, nor do they want to see it being enabled to do that by the West. And that opposition that you're talking about in the region and those issues barely register in the media and the political class.
Except, of course, there's no military opposition that can be expressed. There's no mutual defense pact between Russia and Iran, between China and Iran, even though how close they are with that country. Do you think anyone would want to negotiate with the United States, let alone Israel, ever again? I mean, Russia's made the case about the Minsk agreements being violated. Clearly, these Oman talks designed for the IAEA, after the IAEA report, although Iran said that Mossad had infiltrated IAEA, they produced some evidence, some papers about that, which hasn't been covered very much. You're a former negotiator. What is the point of negotiating? Is it only because the other party is terrified of United States power?
Well, look, I think people will show up. I think people will be willing to attempt to negotiate. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think people should always keep that option open. There's one permanent problem, which is if there is such huge asymmetry and there is a basic monopoly on the negotiation, which in the case of, for instance, Israel-Palestine has been the case with the Americans. And if the monopoly negotiator chooses to exacerbate the asymmetry of power rather than close that gap, then negotiations can never get anywhere if Israel knows that it can act with impunity and do what it wants. There's a different, I think, element that has come into play here with the America-Israel-Iran situation. And I think this is potentially very consequential indeed. It is clear. I don't think this was the case for the months of the talks, but it was clear that this round in Oman and the statements coming from the president, him saying, we'll see what happens in the talks, was used as a decoy, as a deception mechanism to enable Israel to have an element of surprise when it launched its attack.
And Trump knew that.
Well, that's what we understand. That is what...
Well, that's what I was alluding to earlier about Carlson and saying, no, that's impossible. Trump would never be so deceitful.
Well, that's what it looks like. That's what the evidence points in that direction, that he did know the Israelis were going to do this. He did know when the Israelis were going to do this. And he chose to be part of the Israeli head fake, that it wouldn't be happening imminently, to give Israel the element of surprise. Why it is so consequential in the immediate term is consequential in terms of what happened in the initial wave of strikes. But why it's more consequential is the question that you raised, which is, what does it mean for negotiations? What does it mean for American mediation? What does it mean in other places on this globe where people look at it and say, if I go into this process with the Americans, what is the subtext? What is the underlying agenda? And it is encouraging actors to preemptively say, you know what, I don't want to get in a position where America does me up like this. Maybe I'm going to have to take a preemptive action. So you are creating a much more dangerous world. In the meantime, I do think that China is looking to many places in the world like the more reliable, responsible, mature, multilateral actor.
Okay, well, just finally, we've got a minute left. Do you think, people are going to think in different countries that they need nuclear weapons in that kind of context of any framework, future framework of negotiation? Would Netanyahu use nuclear weapons then, as he gets more and more desperate, as talk of radioactivity in this region increases? Is that what we're looking at?
Well, look, we're walking up the escalatory ladder, and Israel is a nuclear-armed state. And you point out something that's hugely important, which, how do you now look at this if you're sitting in Ankara, Turkey? How do you look at this if you're sitting in Pakistan, where Netanyahu has threatened the Pakistani nuclear program in the past?
They have them already.
Exactly. No, I know. So what do you now do? What if you're sitting in the Gulf? What this speaks to, I think, is the extent to which, in its current incarnation, more than ever before, the messianic extremism of that state. You know, Israel's leader talks about a theocratic state with a genocidal agenda and the weapons to deliver it. He seems to be describing his own state. What this seems to speak to is a degree of overreach, which is a danger, of course, for the Palestinians being ethnically cleansed and genocided, for the region, for the world, I would argue, for the Israelis themselves as well.
Daniel Levy, thank you.
Thank you, Abhishek.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of the US-UK EU armed bombing of Gaza and Iran. We'll be back on Monday to find out whether Russia will respond to continued provocation by using nuclear weapons. We'll be speaking to a member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.